Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? It is a pleasure to be here, and congratulations on another group anniversary for you all. And I agree with Pat. You certainly recognize the spirit of the group, and I think it's great. And as I've heard many speakers say, if you don't think your home group is the greatest group in the world, you ought to join another group. You know, because that's the one that ought to be the greatest. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on Pearl Harbor Day of 1964 in Manassas, Virginia, in a little country group meeting, and I have not been drunk since that night, and I owe it all to not drinking. That is, get that out of the way in the beginning. If there is anybody new, that is how you avoid getting drunk. You do not drink. That is, that's like a separate issue over on the side. Then we have this entire program which enables us to get happy with not drinking. So there's the two issues. One is you have to stop drinking, and then the program will help you get happy with that. But a lot of us in the beginning may have been looking for a way to reverse that. I'll get happy first and then stop drinking. That'll be easy. And so occasionally we find victims who are trying to work the steps and drink. Assuming that once you have a spiritual awakening, it'll be a piece of cake to stop drinking. And as my sponsor points out to folks who are interested in this theory, it's very difficult to have a spiritual awakening while you're dry heaving. It's just they don't go hand in hand, if you follow what I mean. There's two different worlds that we're operating in, so that doesn't work. So you really have to get the not drinking part down. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, because if you notice, we don't have a step that says don't drink, and we don't have a slogan that says don't drink. And if you're new and you have a ratty little mind like a lot of new people do, you go, nobody told me. Directly. Nobody specifically said, don't drink. And so, let me be the first to welcome you to AA. Don't drink. There, you heard it now, and you're going to have to drink with guilt. When Pat was talking about Lois, I was thinking about last year. I understand you had Clancy here from California, and I always like, whenever I know that maybe he'll hear about this meeting, I always like to tease California about Alcoholics Anonymous. If anybody isn't familiar with the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous came from the great state of Vermont. Not California. This is very important to us. This is one of the few things, major events, that has occurred in the United States that didn't start in California and work its way across the country, but rather the most unlikely episode. We had two guys from Vermont, where I didn't even know they drank, having a rendezvous in Akron, Ohio. And we started, and that's about 48 years ago. And here, the meeting between those two men has grown into something where I was up at General Service Office a couple months ago talking to Bob P. Up there, and he had just done another count. There's no official records, of course, of AA membership or anything like that, but they can make pretty good guesstimates. And he had said there were 30,000 groups just in Canada and the United States. And they figured that in the rest of the world, there may be another 20,000, which is 50,000 groups like this in well over 104 countries, with probably 1.5 million or 2 million, that is totally hard to guess, recovered alcoholics, all coming as a direct result of these two guys from Vermont meeting in Akron, Ohio. Most unlikely plot you could ever imagine. A stockbroker and a surgeon meeting in Akron, Ohio. And I like to think about that because very often we say, well, the medical profession doesn't know much about AA. And you think back, in the very infancy, 50% of our members were doctors. We should have been able to do better than that, if you know what I mean. But it is a remarkable thing. Everywhere I travel and go to all my meetings around the Washington area, I never cease to be amazed at what we're watching, and I think sometimes we forget what we're watching. That miracles are so commonplace in Alcoholics Anonymous, we just treat them towards them. You know, oh, so what? A brand new person showed up whose life's been in shambles for 20 years and they immediately straightened out. Big deal. I mean, so what do you think is supposed to happen here? And their family's happy now and they're going back to work and and there they are. And tell them to move over because we got another one that just walked in the door. And we go, hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And 3 months later, the person stands up and says, I can't believe it. 3 months ago I came here, I was contemplating suicide, now I'm top of the world. And we all go, right, that's exactly the way it's supposed to happen. That's what happens here. And we forget what we just heard. You know what I mean? We forget what just transpired in that person's lives. And what happened, no matter how you cut it, in the definition that is used in AA, is a miracle, or a spiritual awakening, or a personality change. A person went from a hopeless, negative, pessimistic person into the vibrant, very positive, full of laughter, looking forward to tomorrow kind of people that you see all around the rooms here. And that, to me, is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never fail to get goosebumps when I think about what this is. And how important a contribution this is making all over the place, in the families and the workplace and so on down, by just having people's lives turned around like they are in AA. And I'm no exception. I'm delighted that a good friend of mine, Ed, is here tonight as a visitor. I called him up, hadn't seen him in a number of years, and he was with me during my last year drinking in the Marine Corps, so if anybody doubts anything that I'm saying here tonight, why, you could go up and check with him after the meeting, and we were in an outfit that where drinking was the way of life. When you get in the Marine Corps overseas, everybody was just drunk all the time, and there was this tremendous amount of drinking, and vehicles being stolen and guys riding motorcycles off of Quonset huts and just an endless series, and my drinking stood out. When other guys are going, you drink too much, and they're barely able to stand, you know you have a problem. You know, it's hard to stand out in a crowd like that, but since I've gotten sober and had a chance to visit with some of them over the years, they all agreed that I was in the lead by myself. Although there was one other guy, I don't know if Ed remembers this, but somewhere right near the end, I'm talking about down to my last 3 months of drinking, right before the little episodes that get us into AA took place. The group I was in over in Japan needed an officer with high moral character to go up to another Marine Corps base to escort back an alcoholic who had just gotten out of treatment. And I was chosen to go up. And the two of us were missing for 2 weeks. So, you wonder about some of these things, but that's a true story. I'd forgotten about that, going up to get that guy. I don't really want to feel like going through a long drunkalogue. Suffice it to say that drinking for me, which I did not start until I was about 19 years old in college, was not the same as it was for My college roommates, for example, I've had a chance to visit with them since I've gotten sober, and I've asked them to describe drinking. And they said, well, I'll tell you what drinking was back in college, and still drinking is marvelous. It is a way of making Saturday night better. It is a way of unwinding at the end of the day. It's a way of just enabling a group of people to get to talk to each other a little quicker than they would without drinking. It's a marvelous social tool that we have in our lives. That's their definition of drinking. That's not close to my definition of drinking. If that's all that drinking was, I wouldn't be around here tonight, I can tell you that. Drinking was the secret to life. That's what drinking was. For me, it wasn't some little extra added attraction that made the party a little better. You could cancel the party as long as you left the drinking there. You could send everybody home as long as you left the alcohol there. This stuff was, I didn't realize this. I didn't know that I was different and that this stuff was getting inside and was fixing problems that are supposed to be fixed by other means, such as growing up. That's the normal way that these other problems are fixed. And for us alcoholics, we get a shortcut. And I go, oh, I don't have to learn how to deal with the pain of rejection. I don't feel a thing. And I don't have to learn to deal with fears and anxieties about job interviews. I'll just stop outside the door, snort, snort, knock, knock. Hello, Mr. Jones, I'm here on the interview, we have a marvelous insight into a power source that we hope will stay with us forever. In other words, I developed, without realizing it, a tremendous faith in the chemical alcohol as an answer. And it was a universal answer. It took care of it. I'll tell you, when I heard the promises read here tonight out of the ninth step, I could just think of applying them to vodka. You know what I'm talking about? There you go. They ought to put it on the vodka label. you don't agree with me? My God. Drink this. You will intuitively know how to handle situations that need to happen to you. Are you worried about the past? Forget to drink this. You won't even want to shut the door on it. You're worried. Fear of economic insecurity will leave you. Set up the place, bartender. So all the promises were filled by this power source called drinking. Now, to a degree, other people have some of these same relationships, but as we find out when we get sober and share here in AA, the depth to which we became obsessed with alcohol as the answer to the exclusion of all other things, so that when we're in nut wars and when we're in jails, we are not in a position to reconsider. Even when you're in jail, ready to go up to see the judge for the sixth drunk driving that year, and the thought occurs to us, I wonder if drinking has anything to do with it. We go, no. You know what I mean? It's just, no, that's not it, because drinking is the answer to life. And the answer to life can't be given up. So I'm going to have to find it. In other words, whenever a problem came up, the first step was to make a declaration that it had nothing to do with drinking. Then we went on to figure out what the problem might be, and it was an unkind policeman. They don't like me in this part of the country. They hear my accent and they arrest me. And that's why I'm in jail here today. And in other words, the stuff is so crucial to, in my mind, to surviving in this world that it's too threatening to even consider the idea of going through the rest of my life without drinking. That's what I think alcoholism is. And the obsession to think about drinking as the answer. And the second thing is that as the physical addiction sets in, the problems get so much stronger that we will have to rely on them even more. And now we have that vicious circle where the drinking we're doing today is guaranteeing the problems we'll have tomorrow. And when you think about it, we walk into the package store and we plunk down our $6 or whatever it was for a bottle of booze. What we were really buying is an absolute guarantee that tomorrow will stink. Guarantee. And they say, drink this. And we drink that, and that meant we had to be back tomorrow because we had another terrible day that had to be fixed. And all of this happens a day at a time. You know, it's like the aging process. You don't suddenly notice you're an alcoholic anymore, and you suddenly notice you're old, you know, compared to yesterday. You look back at a picture of your high school graduation class, and you go, holy cow, look at this tremendous difference. And so it is with people that haven't seen us in a number of years. And as our illness progresses, and we see someone we haven't seen in 8 years, they run over and go, are you all right, you know? Hopes and so on down, because to them we look terrible, whereas we don't look much worse than we did yesterday. To us. And so we just can't see this thing coming in, but we do know that we're in more pain, and we know that life is all screwed up, and we start, and since it's not us and it's not the drinking, it has to be them. And we look around, and it's our family and all those kids. I had 6 kids, and they're all over the place. They're in a place to sit down at the table. There they are, and they're yelling, and they're up and down. No wonder I'm drinking all the time. And my wife is always pregnant. And that's no fun, you know. Girls are always pregnant around here. And the Marine Corps is always transferring me every year. Here I go again. No roots, can't get settled. But I love those transfers. You got to start over again. You know what I mean? As if the world was just caving in on you and everybody was just getting ready to get you for your drinking or the problems. And wasn't it wonderful to have a built-in geographic cure where they transferred you? And, the blame has to be placed outside. And that's exactly what was going on in my mind. And the more pain I was in, the more blame had to be placed in the outside. And of course, as life unfolded, the world got worse every year. And pretty soon, I was not looking forward to the future, because all I had to go on was my past. And as I looked ahead, it did not look very encouraging. Because this year, we had, for example, run into grand mal seizures. Hadn't been around last year. And I said, geez, wonder what's going to be next year. Grand mal seizures, what the hell else happens? As this disease unfolds, it does not, and we're not sharing this with anybody. What are we sharing with everybody? How are you doing? Great. Oh, fine. We say it so many times, they wonder what we're talking about. You know, it's an overkill. You talk to an alcoholic, he's shaking, hurting, his face is all red. How are you doing? Fine. Just stay away from me. Don't check up on me. Don't you get in here. Get those dark glasses on so they can't see in those eyes, and look down and fine, and then stay away from people who ask how you are. Keep them away and growl and make noises, because that paranoia, they're going to get in here and they're going to find out, and one of them, one of those that really hates me, is going to suggest don't drink. And they don't understand what they'd be doing if they ever suggested not drinking to this person. It could kill me. That's how they don't understand. Life is treating them fairly. But the pain I'm in, it's no wonder. They'd drink too if they had to go through what I'm going through every night and all of that. So this is all going on in our heads, and we're not sharing it with anybody, so nobody has the slightest idea what in the world is going on inside until we get to AA. When we walk through the door, we think we're the only nut in the world who's been having these kind of absolute fits on our bed at night, just so concerned about the world and what's happening in the family. We come in here, and every jerk that gets up to speak has the same story. The world is filled with people like I am, and I thought I was unique. And that's the wonderful therapy of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to find out how sick everybody else is. It was wonderful to find that out. I just could relax. And then I understood why people could safely say, I don't envy anybody else. I used to hear people say that. I don't envy anybody else. See a rich man, see a tall, good-looking guy or gal. Don't envy them at all. I thought it was being very big on them. What they'd been to a lot of AA meetings, and they knew it wasn't safe to be someone else. That's what it was. Your appearances are very deceiving. Have you noticed that? The bank president arrives and he's all dressed up and he's sitting there and it's his turn to talk. He gets up and you go, my God, I don't believe it. I can't believe he runs a bank. You know, I mean, shares sitting down at the bank and hiding in the vault and drinking and hoping nobody borrowed money. And the guy wants to pay the money back and I don't want to care. My hands are shaking. Keep the money. And you sit there going, God, I wouldn't have pegged him that way. And that was our problem, and we've all heard about it, comparing our insides to other people's outsides. We look at them, and what they're doing is exactly what we're doing to everybody else in the world. We're telling them everything is fine. And pretty soon you go, God, everything's fine for everybody, and I'm dying inside. I hope nobody finds out. So to me, that is the horror of the alcoholism, not being able to share that, not knowing where to go to get answers to that. And the other thing is, I'm sort of grossly oversimplifying all this, but the other thing is that I knew that I was living just the opposite of what I really wanted to be. I didn't want to admit that, but there were those nights but I'd sit on my bed and I'd go, I wish I had been at the hospital when my children were born. I wish I had been at their birthday parties. I wish I had been down at the PTA thing like all the other fathers. I wish I had, and there was an endless series of all these things that I wish I had done. And I wish I knew what people were saying when they say they love their children. I wonder what that really is. And I know what they look like when they're doing it. They touch them and they hug them and they do all that, but how do you remember when to do that? You know, how do you get a schedule so that you can work that into your daily routine? Because when you're self-centered in the extreme, you cannot love. So you can only act like you do. And you can go through the motions of being kind, but you aren't kind. You are just acting kind, because you see that that's how society expects you. Oh, this is where you act kind. Oh, good. How long do I have to stay kind? I'm busy. I need a drink here. I'll be kind for another minute. In other words, there is no kindness, as we understand it in a spiritual program, flowing through us at all, because we've cut off all of that. That doesn't come from human beings. That comes from another power source. And so this became the real painful secret as the years went on, was that I really knew, through my conscience or whatever you want to call it, that I was being just the opposite of what I really wanted to be. And there came the most painful part of all, was what am I going to do about that? What does a human being do when they are behaving just the opposite of the way they really want to be? What do you do about that kind of a situation? If you take an inventory and you sit down and you think about it and you're an alcoholic, you go, let's see, I'm behaving just the opposite of the way I want to be. Well, the behavior is inflexible. You see what I'm saying? That was where you get stuck. Oh, I'm going to change. But I can't change the behavior because that's going to involve not drinking and that can't be done. So that's out. I cannot change the behavior. So I'm going to have to work on the other side, which is there's something inside of me that wants me to be good. If I could shut that up, I would have peace of mind. You see the insanity of us alcoholics. If we could put to sleep permanently that good part of us, we would then have peace of mind. I could then really be a badass. If I were just really bad, then what I'm doing, I would be in harmony with who I am. So I'm going to be bad, 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 bad. And then we're in there trying to kill the very soul or the very essence of ourselves. And I don't know about you all, but the only way I could do it was by passing out. by passing out. One way to get peace of mind was to not think. Just turn the brain off and just stay and just drink and down. And then that was the closest thing I could come to peace of mind. And as the illness got near the end, that was what I was trying to do, was to shut me up. I didn't even need my wife around or a Marine colonel or anybody else to yell at me. I was yelling at me, always. When is this going to stop? When are you going to... And I'd go, you're going to shut up. Boy, I finally shut that voice up, that little something inside of us that registers in the final analysis the ultimate disapproval. And I think this is probably the moment when we read about people committing suicide or driving into a bridge abutment or something in the last stages of their illness. They go, there isn't any way out of this pain. I cannot change the way I'm behaving, and I can't kill that part of me, so I'll just wipe the whole ballgame out. And our problem, of course, is we're trying to handle this alone. Our pride and whatever, our fear and all of that prevented us from ever sharing what was going on inside with another human being. So we had the ultimate dilemma of the classic alcoholic. Stuck with this problem and no way to ever have it get resolved unless something happens. And the something that happens is our individual stories. As we go all around the room, well, we would hear various people, somebody got stopped for DWI, somebody had a heart attack, somebody's boss said, come on in, I want you to meet your replacement. Me? Our doctor said, well, I just finished your physical. If I was you, I wouldn't buy any long playing records. You know, but you have about an hour to live. Oh, and then they explain our alcoholism, and something happens to get our attention. Somebody takes away our choice and sticks us in an AA meeting, and then we get up here and tell about how it was and how we got here. And there's a guy who I always like to quote that came from the Washington, D.C. area and moved down to Alabama and then subsequently passed away some 6 or 7 years ago, but he was a great favorite of mine. Around the AA program up there, he spoke a great deal in the Washington area. His name was Charlie Gruden, and he was a lawyer with the House of Representatives, if I recall. And Wallace had got up and talked about, people would ask Charlie what he thought about AA. And Charlie would say, Alcoholics Anonymous, it beat lying in the weeds. What's this distinguished gentleman get up and say, it beats lying in the weeds? And he'd say, a lot of people who don't understand alcoholism don't understand why that's a big compliment. But if you've ever been out in the middle of a hot asphalt parking lot at 12 noon on a hot broiling day and you can't move, and that sun is beating down on you, and those flies are all buzzing around, and the people are going in and out of the shopping center are looking at you lying next to your car. And you look over, and about 50 yards away are those weeds. And you say, man, if I could just get over to those weeds. And it would be... Nobody could see me over in the weeds. And it'd be shady, and when the wind blows, those weeds would keep the flies off. And when I say AA beats lying in the weeds, I am saying some big thing. And so that was sort of the flavor of Charlie's talk. And he always had the same two jokes that he told, that the guy walked into the pizza house and ordered a little pizza, and the manager says, you want this cut in 8 pieces or 4? And he went, 4, I'm not that hungry. And then his other little story was the new guy came into the AA meeting and he thought he'd be real clever, and he got the secretary over and he said, I see the clock over there, it says that clock says 10 of 9, and the one over there says 10 after 9. And the the secretary said, if they both said at the same time, it wouldn't need but one clock.
So let us know that story.
That a very short sentence that really explains alcoholism or helps me understand it. The whole saying that says, it isn't so much the things that you don't know that kill you, it's knowing things that just ain't so. And this is the difference. For me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that's what our Chapter 5 says when it said, old ideas availed us nothing. We knew a bunch of things for sure that were wrong. I knew a whole bunch of things that for absolutely sure that were wrong. I was not an alcoholic. There was no God. I knew that for sure. People in general are bad. I knew that for sure. I'm no good. I knew that for absolute sure. And my family's no good. And the world is not fair. Oh, is it not fair? All of these things I knew for absolute sure. And isn't that a shame? Because those things weren't true at all. But my thinking that they were true made life extremely painful for me. And what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is that saying that Charlie talked about, it isn't that we learn a whole bunch of new things. Sponsor. I'll tell you that. I'm not getting a sponsor, you know. And a couple months later, he's confronted with a situation. He either gets a sponsor or his wife leaves him. Well, all right, I'll get a sponsor. But I'm not reading the big book. I can tell you that. I'm not going to get into that spiritual stuff. I'm not going to be getting into that. And then you see him about a year later, and he's leading a spiritual meeting somewhere. Hey, you have to change your mind? Yeah, I did change my mind on that. And our sobriety is measured by the number of times we've changed our mind. You know what I mean? When we finally change it on everything, we'll have pretty close to peace of mind and a little bit of humility. It's those of us that cling to those old ideas. We can understand why the rest of the dummies changed their minds. They had dumb ideas. Made sense for that half the room to change their mind, but us, over here, the enlightened crowd, why the hell should we change our mind? We're on to truth. You remember that? And when Clancy, did he mention that when he was here? He talked about being in that jail in Texas, and he was one of three people in the world that knew truth. For people who know truth, it's hard to change your mind. It's hard to see your way clear to change our mind. And yet, that's what goes on in AA. It's an endless inventory. When some people ask me, they go, "What are you, is this a religious program?" And I go, "No, it isn't. I don't go to church. A lot of AA members do go to church, but I'm one who doesn't. But I consider that my entire sobriety rests on a spiritual program. And that I need spiritual principles and I need all of this." And so it is this world of difference. There's similarities, but there's a great deal of difference between a religious program and a spiritual program such as this. And so people say, what is, name something spiritual. So I'll name what I think is one of the most spiritual things we have in AA, inventories. We got two steps full of inventories, and it is a spiritual thing where a human being at given intervals, either certain times during the day, the end of the day, a couple times during the year, sets down and stops life for a while in order to take stock of themselves for the sole purpose of fitting into the world better, of seeing what it is about us that may be out of sync with the rest of the world and with what we have come to understand our higher power might be, in order that we might just do the job a little bit better. And for people, self-centered alcoholics in particular, to ever be engaged in this kind of pursuit is a miracle. I mean, we have a slogan in Alcoholics Anonymous called First Things First. And I'm convinced that what that really came from is probably out of the third step and all of the spiritual principles of the program, that somehow, and Bill writes this I don't know how many times in the big book in the 12 and 12, we have to put spiritual values first. And so this character building or spiritual growth or learning about spiritual principles goes from an unknown quantity in our lives slowly up the ladder, slowly up the ladder, attempting to get into first place. Of course, it has to go by bowling or golf. And to move character building up near bowling or golf is quite a undertaking, if you think about it. I hadn't even moved it up to the Reader's Digest. You know, the sharpening hockey skates and things like that. It just was not on my list of things that I was looking forward to moving ahead. And yet that's the dilemma of sobriety. The longer we stay sober, the less likely it is that we can coast, because it builds up the same kind of a problem that was going on in our drinking, in my opinion. There's something inside of us that's keeping score with how we're doing in sobriety, just like there was something inside of us that was keeping score in how we were doing in our drinking, and eventually it got so painful near the end that we had to do something about it. So I think the same thing happens in the program. We can come around, and we can stop drinking and go to meetings and hang around the winners, and that's a wonderful way to get started. But if you're like some of us, and have 6 or 7 years, and that's your whole program, it's probably not too comfortable, because you're behaving like a newcomer. You have not moved beyond the, I'm just not drinking and going to meetings and hanging around with winners. We still haven't changed. We haven't changed our mind on anything other than not drinking and going to meetings. There's all the rest of this work, and we hear other people talking about it, and it makes us uncomfortable. I'm sharing this from my own personal experience. I would go to groups where they were going, yes, now I've been to an inventory yesterday, and I'll be taking my fifth step tomorrow, and I'll kind of go, Jesus, this crowd is nuts. I'm in with the fanatical element of alcoholism. Some of these people have been sober less than 3 years, and they're talking about the steps already. I'm going to go over to the other side of Washington and see what they're doing over there. And you start looking around for groups that aren't doing anything. And then you go, hey, good. And you get these little things like, us losers got to stick around together. You know, some of the marvelous things that you can hear. And it's a way, and we just, you know, don't want to change. And if the sobriety is anything, it is a process of change. It is an endless process of change, and there's just no way to avoid it. Because there seems to be this internal clock that's going on inside. We can fool everybody else, but there's something inside of us that says, you know, other people with 7 years sobriety, boop, like that, and you ain't there yet. And you just know it, and then you try to explain it, and there's something inside of us that says, you know, last week it occurred to you to make an amend to your ex-mother-in-law, and you rejected it. Does anybody ever have things occur to them and say, where does that come from? Some goddamn idea just occurred to me. Push that idea down and go on about whatever the hell we had planned for ourselves that day. You know, when it says intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us, the intuitive sometimes comes from things occurring to us. That's they kind of connected there, that out of the blue comes the thought, I ought to do this. And then we act on it, and then we get the reward of acting on it, and it's, and we go, and maybe we go and we talk to this person that we haven't talked to, and it just occurred to us to call, and they go, how'd you pick this time? What a coincidence. I was just thinking about you. Isn't that amazing? And you go, I don't know, it just occurred to me. And when a number of these occurrences happen and we start working the program a little bit, I think it suddenly becomes apparent to us that it all makes sense, that it is part of something that we're on to, and these steps are not haphazard put together, that in fact this is a plan for living that was as much a secret to life as our old drinking was, that we've been given what we needed and what our first step says we need, which is a power source. It wasn't the ignorance, it was a lack of power. Back when we needed the drinking to get up the courage to go in on the job interview, it wasn't that we didn't know how to go in on the job interview, we didn't have the power to go in there. And then we drank and got a little authority. You remember that saying? A little authority on his breath. And we walked into the job interview. And so we find now very often we'll get ready to go into the job interview or whatever the threatening situation might be, and we stop outside, we pause for a second, and we call our higher power. And we get our higher power assembled with us, and we knock on the door, and we go, we are here for the job interview. And you and your higher power walk in and do great. Yes, that'll be fine. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And you walk out, and then we forget to take our higher power somewhere, and we get real nervous, and we get real lonesome again, and we get the feeling of being out of power. Because these tools that have been given to us, that's what happened. I don't understand alcoholism. I don't have the slightest idea why I'm an alcoholic, so I don't know anything hardly about alcoholism. You know what happened to my alcoholism? It went away somewhere. It doesn't come up on my agenda on a daily basis to bug me. I forgot to worry about drinking. What the big book says, the problem was not solved, it was removed. We have a spiritual reprieve, a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. In other words, I just go through life and if I'm doing the program right, I forget to think and worry about drinking. I just look back, and last year I didn't think or worry about drinking. I didn't do it myself. It just never happened to me. It didn't happen the year before. It didn't happen the year before. It didn't happen the year before. Isn't that amazing? It's, you know where it is? It's in the league with my coloring book and crayons. They don't come up worrying me anymore. You know what I mean? I don't remember what year it was, but I stopped worrying about them, and it just doesn't occur to me, and they're gone. I think I've outgrown crayons and coloring book, and in a sense, if I'm working this program, I think I just outgrew drinking. I outgrew what drinking was for. I found an alternative to drinking that fixes all other areas of my life so well that drinking no longer is even... Why would I want to bring it up for an agenda item? It serves no purpose in a life that has found the power source here in AA. I think the last thing I'll say before I sit down is something about this day-at-a-time program as incorporated in our 10th step, which to me, if there's anybody new, this gives us a game plan for living a day at a time. It teaches us just some very fundamentals about getting through a day. And if there's a couple of points that work well for me that maybe will work well for you, then I'll share them with you. One of them Bill writes about in the 12 and 12 called self-restraint. He suggests that us drunks on a daily basis get up in the morning and ask for a cushion of self-restraint between us and the world. That is a very legitimate thing to ask for starting a day out. Give me about 10 seconds between what happens to me and me doing anything. And you can't produce that yourself. Again, I can't. But I can ask for it. And the funny thing is, coincidentally, when I ask for it, it comes around. I look back at the end of the day and I go, isn't that amazing how people were all straightened out today? I can't believe how they were straightened out. And what I did was I asked for this flexibility, for this self-restraint, for this cushion around me, so that when things happen and they hurt or they do this and that, I get a chance to have the hurt work and then think about it a second and then do what I'm going to do, rather than punch or say those words or write this letter or make this phone call. And I end up, in a lot of cases, thinking it through that I might as well not do that. And there are a lot of little things that happen where I don't behave in a way that I have to apologize later on, where I did not get out of step, so to speak, with the rest of the world. I used to think that days, and you may have heard this little analogy before, were like a pinball machine. And I was one of those balls down in the pinball machine, down there in the dark. And we hung around down there and bitched about the rough life out there. You know, like in a bar. And then all of a sudden the goddamn day would start. You know, cut, you could hear the, uh-oh, here we go, the alarm clock's going off. I'll be out there any second, you know. And then wham, and you're up, you know. Here I go, they're kicking me out the door. I got to go to work now. And they pull the plunger in. Wham, and here we go. The world's out of control again. Over here, over there, around, around, you know, just around and around, and you're going, where the hell is that little hole that sucks back in there? Get out of this damn thing. It is rough out here. I'm like, help, help, help. And we can see that little hole down there. Man, I'll be there in a minute, and you're just getting ready to duck in there, and a flipper comes up. And you're all the way back up to the top, and then, you come in here, man, I need a drink. It's rough. That to me was life. You know what I mean? I said, God, it's rough out there. It's rough out there. And I had no idea that there were principles, there were ways of getting through this. I had no flexibility. I was like the song in World War II. Some of you may remember it. It was a song called Johnny One Note. Anybody here old enough to remember that? Poor Johnny One Note. Poor Johnny, he only knew how to play one note, and he's trying to get a job in a band. Only knew how to play it, you know, thing. And poor Johnny One Note can't fit in anywhere. He just knows one note, you know, and it's only one out of however many notes there are that he's in harmony with anything. Oh, very good, you know, and if he could just get everyone else to play stuff in harmony with his note, we could have an orchestra going, you know. And so he went around explaining everybody his problem. Only played the one note. And I think that's what us alcoholics, self-centered, all we knew was one note. Me! And we thought our job in life was to explain ourselves more completely to other people. And we were willing to go on endlessly. We'd be willing to even write it down for them. I like my eggs cooked this way. I like to wake up and say it's there. That's me. Do you see me here, here, here? Now, let's go, folks. I've briefed you wrong. You're not. Don't laugh when I'm doing that. And we're out there, as Bill writes in the big book, the stage manager directing everybody. We've written the script. We've got it all set. And what we're taught in this 10th step is how to be flexible, how to have this cushion, how to live in harmony with what's going on around us, the ability to change, the ability to have this. And when it's wrong, you know what that principle is in the 10th step, that spiritual axiom that says when there's something disturbs us, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us. And always put it back on us. If I'm disturbed, I'm wrong. Because I can get undisturbed without changing anything out there. Oh, that's impossible. Oh, yeah, used to do it with vodka. Used to do it with vodka. It's not impossible if you have a power source. What we have is the power. Oh, I'm disturbed. I have higher power. I'd like to get undisturbed. Glad to help you out. We use that. Hey, higher power, I'm disturbed. Change that. And he wouldn't listen to our prayers. You remember that? So we stopped believing in him. We were praying for the wrong thing. We had the wrong principle that we were trying to incorporate into our lives. And I think in our 10th step, we're given the very practical ability to float through a day, to just go out and wherever it takes us, to enjoy it. We're not in charge of the trip. We're in charge of evaluating it. At the end of the day, when we've lived according to these principles, we can sit down and take the end of the day inventory. And I'm sure whenever a drunk is sitting on his or her bed at the end of the day, reviewing it, counting where we might do a little bit better, and being grateful for the things that did work out well, where we did behave well, I'm sure that any higher power looking down on one of us drunks doing that is smiling. Thank you very much.